This message is the property of H. David Edwards and Elam Bible Institute, and presented free of charge for private use only. Permission to use this message publicly may be requested by contacting Elam Bible Institute at 7245 College Street, Lima, New York, 14485.
With joy, the Elam Tape Department brings to you David Edwards. The title of his message is The Conflict Between Revelation and Experience. This message was given on October 15, 1978, at Elam Bible Institute.
I'd like to draw your attention this morning to the book of the prophet Habakkuk. One of my friends pointed out for me that 2 weeks ago, I introduced you to Habakkuk and then left him. We didn't leave him entirely in the wilderness, but we did take a preliminary glance at the ministry of a prophet. And in that connection, I would like to say to those of you who heard Brother Bob Mumford on Wednesday that there was no collusion between us. I think that it might not have been without significance that 2 weeks ago today, in our Sunday evening service, I spoke to you about the prophet and his ministry. He was not here and knew nothing of what I had said. And then when he arrived on Wednesday, he shared with us on the same topic. I suggest for you that it would be profitable to hear his tapes. If you can't afford to buy four of his, buy one of mine. That's not to say that I said in one tape what he took four to say, but I thought it was somewhat unusual that so many of the things that I had said 2 weeks ago he repeated on Wednesday morning. Now, I'd like to read some of these opening verses from this prophet and trust that the reading of the first chapter will not prove too long for us. I'm reading from a book called Living Prophecies. Don't often make use of this paraphrase, but it's not inappropriate in the light of what I want to say to you. This is the message that came to the prophet Habakkuk in a vision from God. O Lord, as I call for help before you will listen. I shout to you in vain. There is no answer. Help! Murder! I cry, but no one comes to save. Must I forever see this sin and sadness all around me? Wherever I look, there is oppression and bribery, and men who love to argue and to fight. The law is not enforced, and there is no justice given in the courts. For the wicked far outnumber the righteous, and bribes and trickery prevail. The Lord replied, "Look and be amazed. You will be astounded at what I am about to do. For I am going to do something in your own lifetime that you will have to see to believe. I am raising a new force on the world scene, the Chaldeans, a cruel and violent nation who will march across the world and conquer it. They are notorious for their cruelty. They do as they like and no one can interfere. Their horses are swifter than leopards. They are a fierce people, more fierce than wolves at dusk. Their cavalry move proudly forward from a distant land. Like eagles, they come swooping down to pounce upon their prey. All opposition melts away before the terror of their presence. They collect captives like sand. They scoff at kings and princes and scorn their forts. They simply heap up dirt against their walls and capture them. They sweep past like wind and are gone. But their guilt is deep, for they claim their power is from their gods. O Lord, my God, my Holy One, you who are eternal, is your plan in all of this to wipe us out? Surely not, O God, our rock. You have decreed the rise of these Chaldeans to chasten and correct us for our awful sins. We are wicked, but they far more. Will you, who cannot allow sin in any form, stand idly by while they swallow us up? Should you be silent while the wicked destroy those who are better than they? Are we but fish to be caught and killed? Are we but creeping things that have no leader to defend them from their foes? Must we be strung up on their hooks and dragged out in their nets while they rejoice? Then they will worship their nets and burn incense before them. These are the gods who make us rich, they'll say. Will you let them get away with this forever? Will they succeed forever in their heartless wars? Now let me read the conclusion of the book from King James Version. Although the fig tree shall not blossom, neither shall fruit be in the vines, the labor of the olive shall fail, and the field shall yield no food, the flock shall be cut off from the fold, and there shall be no herd in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord, I will joy in the God of my salvation. The Lord God is my strength, and he will make mine feet like hinds' feet, and he will make me walk upon my high places. Now, Habakkuk is like Jonah and Hosea in the fact that they're somewhat different from the other books that we call the minor prophets. They are different in as much as there is very little foretelling in any one of these books. They're different in as much as Hosea is the experience of a prophet, Jonah is the history of a prophet, and Habakkuk summarizes the questions of a prophet. One of the things that encourages me about this man is to recognize that God is not frightened by our questions. There are some Christians, apparently, who assume that to be questioning is to be unbelieving. But I'd like to remind you that the major prophets, as well as the minor prophets, were men who questioned. Peter tells us that. He says these men were moved by the Holy Spirit, but they did not understand what it was that they were saying, so they asked God questions. They searched. I remind you that John the Baptist was a man who asked questions. I remind you that Jesus himself asked questions. Not questions simply directed at his hearers in order to educate them, but at least on one occasion, he asked a question of his Father. Certainly, it was only that one occasion, but he did ask it. So it's not illegitimate for us to be questioning about the substance of our faith. Habakkuk is puzzled. And the difficulty that confronts him is the difficulty that faces all of us when we endeavor to reconcile the God that we know with the God that we see. Habakkuk is puzzled because of the conflict that there is between his revelation, the God that he knows, and his experience, the God that he sees. It's not always possible to make things add up logically, and that might lead to frustration. It is said that, not illegitimately, it seems to me that the first chapter is the chapter of a sigh. Oh God, I don't understand. Anybody ever said that? What is it that you're up to? I thought I knew you so well. Haven't you made promises to me? Now look what's happened. The chapter of a sigh. Chapter 2 is the chapter of a sob. And chapter 3 is the chapter of a song. As I thought about it during this past week, it occurred to me that Habakkuk passes from a question mark to an exclamation mark. That's what God delights to do. He delights to take the crookedness of a question mark and make it the straightness of an exclamation mark. Habakkuk is obliged to ask questions because of his sheer honesty, but also his questions arrive from his ignorance. It seems to me that what happens for him is the same kind of thing that happens for us. We see a part of God and suppose that in the part we have the whole. We have a concept and we suppose that our concept is God. What Habakkuk had to learn was that God was bigger than Habakkuk had discovered him to be. We're all aware that it sometimes happens that children who were raised in a Christian home sometimes discard their faith. I am suspicious that one of the reasons for that kind of thing happening is what I've already referred to, that we stay with a concept instead of growing into God. Because when our faith is discarded in the beginning of our college days, it is sometimes left behind because our understanding of the world is being enlarged and we are still left with what we might call a Sunday school concept of God. And what we need to do is to recognize that God is bigger than we will ever learn him to be. Now, there are two things that puzzle Habakkuk in this first chapter. The fact that God is doing nothing, and then the fact that he's doing something. God's inexplicable inactivity. He seems to be so far removed from where we are. He's always far removed if you think that he's like a bellboy. If you consider that all you have to do is to dial the emergency code in order to get a hotline, he's always far away. But that is not Habakkuk's concern. He's not concerned because God does not dance attendance on him. He's concerned because God doesn't appear to be concerned about him. That is, God does not appear to be concerned about God. It's not so much that Habakkuk isn't being delivered. What Habakkuk is concerned for is that God is not being honored. Job had a problem with God because of his individual experience. Habakkuk had a problem with God because of national experience. Have you noticed that God never seems to take advantage of the potential that we offer him? So much more could be accomplished if he really were to see how eager we are to get on with a job. I recall watching Newton Edwards lay the bricks around this tabernacle and around one or two other buildings on campus. And like every other bricklayer, he would regularly come to a place where he needed just half a brick. And because he'd been at it for a long time, it was a very easy matter for him to provide for half a brick. He would take a brick and look at it and take his trowel and gauge the hole that he had to fill and then take the trowel and hit it just once and it would break so very, very cleanly and it would just fit. It would only be 15 seconds and it would be over with. The Kohinoor diamond, the largest diamond ever discovered, had to be cut. And the diamond cutter who was commissioned to do it took that rough stone and did nothing but look at it for 6 months. Now, diamond cutters are paid more than the minimum wage. How would you like to be paying a diamond cutter who did nothing but look for 6 months? And at the end of that time, he filed a small notch in the Kohinoor diamond, put an iron bar in it with a chisel edge, and then tapped it with a hammer. And nothing happened. His friend, who was looking on, said, "Do it again." So he did it again. Hit it harder, and that time it broke along the lines that this particular diamond cutter had seen during his 6 months examination. Now, the action in cutting a brick and the action in cutting the diamond was the same. But one was a diamond and the other was a brick. One was a brick, and if you make a mistake with a brick, you can probably replace it for about a quarter. But you'd need several king's ransoms to replace the Kohinoor diamond. And although the man who was paying the diamond cutter might have been a little bit frustrated about having him wait for 6 months, he would have been even more frustrated if he'd made a mistake. Now, here we have a record covering some several hundred years of God's dealings with humans. I don't know where you date the creation of Adam. On the meanest estimate, it was at least 4,000 years before Christ. That might not satisfy your inquiring mind. Archbishop Usher, it was, who said 4,004. Somebody else said 8:45 a.m. on Thursday, the 22nd of October, 4,004. If that doesn't satisfy you, I don't know what will. But there it is. It is at least 4,000 years before Christ. So we've got 4,000 years and maybe, what, 100 years after. Where would you say is the midpoint in that chronicle of history? Page 600, Song of Solomon. Page 800, Habakkuk, where would you say it comes? The midpoint of the time recorded is about Genesis 11. Because, as I've already said, if Adam was created 4,000 years before Christ, then the midpoint is the call of Abraham. If Adam was created more than 4,000 years before Christ, I don't know where the midpoint comes. Now, that looks a little bit disproportionate, doesn't it? I mean, after all, those 20 or 30 pages to Genesis 11 and those 12 or 13 or 1,400 pages to the end of the book of the Revelation. However, who are we to say that the rest of it really records what God feels about time, or whether the first 10 chapters recall what God feels about time? See, I meet some people, and their attitude seems to be suggesting that if God doesn't do it in our generation, he's never going to be able to do it. I can understand, but I don't think God's perspective is exactly like that. He's been around for longer than we have, and he knows better. See, Phillips Brooks was a noted American preacher of another day, and he was found in his study going backwards and forwards like some lion in a cage. He was enraged. Ooh. And his friend who met him didn't understand what was happening and so said, "Brooks, whatever's the matter with you?" And the preacher stopped for long enough to say, "I'm in a hurry, but God isn't." I've heard preachers say, if God doesn't move fast, he's never going to catch up with the devil. Well, I'm suspicious that really they're headed in opposite directions. God's apparent inactivity, he doesn't do anything. And then when it is that you twist his arm to provoke him to really to do something, you find that what he's going to do is not what you had asked for. I would like to ask the fathers who are here, have you ever gone into the toy department of a large store and seen some intriguing toy? You don't really know what it does. You want to find out, so you wind it up and set it down. And it makes a noise like a buzz saw and a police siren and an emergency alarm. And everybody in the store looks at you. So you put your hands in your pockets and you walk away from it, all unconcerned, you know. I didn't do it. That's the kind of thing that Habakkuk knows. He says, "God, why don't you do something?" God said, "I'll show you what I'm going to do." Habakkuk said, "I wish I'd never asked." I am suspicious that I can't really demonstrate this, but I am suspicious that the older you get, the less interest you have in knowing the future. I can't demonstrate that because I'm not yet old enough, but I am suspicious that that is so. In kindergarten, you're very interested in knowing the future. Who'll be my girlfriend in first grade? Who will I marry in third grade? What will my father give me for my birthday? What will I get for Christmas? Where will we go on vacation? What are the results of my examination? A great interest in knowing the future. I'm suspicious that the more past we have, the less interest we have in the future. I wonder why it is that so many new Christians, for them, the only book in the Bible is the book of the Revelation. Teach me the book of the Revelation. I wish I knew the book of the Revelation. Any preacher who has a series on the book of the Revelation is guaranteed of a hearing. I think that our Christian life begins perhaps with hope, progresses to faith, and ends in love. And I think that there is something unhealthy about our curiosity about what God is going to do tomorrow. Of course, Habakkuk found out, and it wasn't at all what he had envisaged. Habakkuk had been complaining about the evil of God's people. God says, "I'm going to use a people who are far worse than they are." The children of Israel were bad enough, but the Chaldeans were worse. The Chaldeans learned how to skin a man while keeping him alive. They killed him after they'd skinned him. They had another practice. They would take the heads off their prisoners of war and heap them up like a pyramid, trophies. And Habakkuk knew about them. And God said, "I am going to use them." Habakkuk said, in effect, "I don't see how you can." We are better than they are. You're not even using us. Now you're going to use them. I don't understand how you can do that in the light of your nature. You're holy. I don't see how you can do it in light of the fact that you're eternal, almighty. God says, it's because I am holy, it's because I am eternal, it's because I am almighty that I can do it. See, Habakkuk saw the tide coming in, threatening to swamp the rock. But if you watch the tide, you can know that the tide's going to go back and the rock is still going to be there. There are people who are concerned about the tide of communism, the tide of humanism, the tide of materialism, the tide of pursuit of pleasure, the tide of hedonism. I want to say something to you. The tide's going to go out. The rock's going to be there. That's what the prophet said was one of his names for God. He said, God, my rock. He said, you leave me confused. You leave me confused because the Chaldeans will be able to say that their gods are stronger than our gods. And God said, that's how it will look for the time being. But don't panic. Now, it's hardly likely that there are too many of us who will have been concerned for God's name in international affairs. Some of us might have been. Some of us, looking at the way in which world forces are gathering themselves together, might have been concerned for God in that. I think that most of us, however, will have been concerned for God in smaller things than world affairs. My finances, my family, myself, my purpose in life, my grades, my goals. Those are not earth-shaking things, except for the people who are involved. But the same kind of difficulty faces us when we ask God questions about those things as when we ask God questions about international affairs. Now, Habakkuk discovered a secret. He said in chapter 2, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to go to God in my tower. I'm going to talk to him, and I'll wait to see what he answers. Now, in the light of all that, whether your problems are universal in scope or whether they are very personal and individual even, I think that there are some just suggestions that I can make to you in the light of Habakkuk's experience that will be helpful. The first thing that the prophet did was to stop. That's not a bad idea, is it? The first thing that the prophet did was not to push the panic button. I think sometimes that's our first inclination. Here we go. The prophet said, I am going to go into my high tower. Now, whether or not that was a literal, actual building, we don't know. I think he might have been saying, I am going to retire within the secret chamber of my own soul in order to commune with God. He stopped. Then I would suggest that he meditated and he asked himself whether or not there was a possibility that there might be an alternate explanation for the things that were happening to him than the first one that occurred to him. When we see things that look black and hostile and adverse, our first reaction is to feel. He's going to clobber me. He's caught me. I've been found out. I'm going to be judged. It might be that God has some meaning in those things other than the meaning that you first attribute to them. I remember in about 1962 or 63, I was hedged about with a whole set of circumstances, not entirely of my making, but to which I had contributed without question. And for me, the future looked pretty bleak. And if those things had really come to fruition in the way that I was thinking, it would have been an end to my preaching. And I said, if I can't preach, take me home. I don't want to live if I can't preach. Now, I was wrong in saying that, but that's what I said. However, as time went by, I found that those things which were hostile were really liberating, because it was the pressure that I was under then that brought me here. Now, I thank God for that. I didn't at the time. All that I could see was calamity, perversity, hostility, disaster, judgment. What God was doing was bringing me into a large place. Stop. Meditate. Ask yourself whether or not the circumstances that appear to be so threatening might really have an explanation other than the one that you have so rapidly given to them. Some of you might have heard me speak about the automobile of my dreams. I haven't yet discovered any manufacturer who's prepared to relate to me in it, but one of these days he will. A Cadillac. Of course, although I'm reflecting on that, maybe a Jaguar. It's going to be a good car to begin with, but it's going to have some refinements. The only thing I know about an automobile is to sit behind the wheel and turn the key on and manipulate the pedals. I don't know anything else. And naturally, at this time of the year, I would choose to head south. Well, there's a button on the dash and it says warm, and I know what that means, and I push it and I get warm. But as I go south, my automobile begins to be uncomfortable, and I notice that the second button over, next door to the one that was marked warm, was marked cool. So I pushed it and I investigated, and lo and behold, the comfort in my the environment in my automobile was improved. But then I found that I ran out of road. There was no bridge. It was a wide river, about a mile and a quarter. And the road ended at this side and it began on the other side. But there was no bridge and there was no ferry. Now, just out of the corner of my eye, as I was pushing the cool button, I had seen a button that was marked submerge. Now, I had to go south. I had never done it before. I had proven the manufacturer in the area of warm and cool. My faith had really to be stretched. I pushed the submerge button. And there was a whirring in the roof of my Jaguar. And something happened, because I noticed that there was something that dropped down in front of me, and it looked just like a periscope. Well, I took my life in my hands and I headed for the river. And I drove across on the bed of the river and I came up on the other side. And I was unharmed. Now, the road that was ahead of me was straight and flat and reminded me of a runway. And I wanted to fly. And I had seen as I passed the submerge button that the one next over was really marked flight. I could hardly keep my finger away from it. And eventually I pushed it. And there was another whirring sound, and I noticed that stubby little wings were sprouting from my Jaguar. And I accelerated, and I pulled back on the wheel, and we took off. See? Now, the point that I make is that the heater and the air conditioner and the periscope and the wings were not add-on accessories. They came with a package. But I would never have discovered the wonder of what I had purchased unless I had been placed in circumstances that were so threatening that I was obliged to experiment. Now, I want to say to you that God is not as easily panicked as you are. And he knows that the best way to learn to swim is at the deep end. He won't push you in without help. But there are times when he'll take away visible supports in order that you might learn the wonder of his relationship with you. How else are you going to find out what really you got when you got Jesus? Because most of us are cowards. Conservative cowards. We would rather depend on that which we have already trusted than go out on thin ice. Talk about going on thin ice. What do you do if there's no ice at all? Only water to walk on. I recall hearing a French pastor relate his experience in this connection. He says that God called him, and he began to follow God, and in his vision, he came to a place where there was a deep ravine, but he didn't mind because there was a four-lane highway on the bridge that crossed the ravine. So he set out to follow God, knowing that God wanted him on the far side. He'd only gone part way when very suddenly the bridge disappeared, and there was only a 9-inch plank. He could no longer see the bottom of the ravine, but God still said, come. So he started to walk on the plank, not quite as confidently as he had been over the four-lane highway bridge, but still walking. And then the plank disappeared, and there was only a rope. And he'd never walked a rope in his life, but he knew that God wanted him on the far side, so he was obliged to walk the rope. And then he said the rope disappeared and there was just nothing. And he was only halfway over. And God still said, come. So he still had to walk. And that, I believe, is the way in which God teaches us that you can count on him. You see, look at what Habakkuk said in the closing verses of his book. And I question whether that kind of faith can ever be surpassed. He said, I'll trust you when I'm not prospering. No fruit in the barns, no fruit in the vine. My herd is dwindling in size. There's nothing left. But by this time, I've come to know who you are. And it's not simply your word that I trust. It's your nature that I'm confident in. It's not simply that you've spoken to me, but I know who you are, and I trust you. You see, if you think about this question of moving from question marks to exclamation marks, you'll see how different that is from what the world does. The world will change an exclamation mark into a question mark. God will say, this is my word. But the world will say, we're not sure. Jesus will be resurrected from the dead, and that's an exclamation mark if ever there was one. But the world will say, I'm not sure. The world changes verities into ambiguities. But God changes uncertainties into those things that you can count on. He delights to take the crookedness of our question mark and straighten it and use it as his punctuation mark, an exclamation mark. What would you rather live your life by? A question mark? What kind of assurance is there in a question mark? You don't have to be afraid of asking questions, But there's no certainty in a question. You need more than a question mark to base your life on. What God gives us is that tremendous exclamation mark of Calvary and all that surrounds it. And you can be sure of this, that no matter what life holds for you, it will never be as black as it was between Calvary and resurrection. Never. It'll never be as dark again at any time as it was between Good Friday and Easter Sunday. Over that intervening time, there was a question mark. But on Easter Sunday, God made his exclamation mark. I'm going to ask you to sing a hymn. It's a strange kind of hymn because it says over and over and over again, I don't know. That's hardly an appropriate hymn at a time like this, is it? It says, I don't know. Each verse begins in that way. 371. Five verses saying, I know not, I know not, I know not. You're going to have to sing each verse. Five times you're going to have to sing, I know not. But five times you're going to have to sing, but I know. For every time you have to sing, I know not, you're going to be able to sing, but I know. In fact, we're going to sing the chorus one more time. One more time in the verse. I know not how, I know not why, I know not when, I know not what. I know not how, but I know him. Thank you. Shall we stand? 371. Please ask questions, but don't build your life on your questions. You might think of more questions than apparently God is willing currently to answer, but he's given you enough answers upon which you can build your life. Build your life on his answers, not on your questions. A question mark is an unstable foundation. But God's exclamation mark is going to be there for eternity. You can count on it, and you can count on him. Amen. Let's pray, and Brother Richard Beals is going to come and pray with us at the conclusion of this service.